The following presentation is not suitable for young children. Listener discretion is advised. Karim Hijazi sat alone in his plush office, drenched in cold sweat as he stared at his computer screen. Hijazi was the young CEO of Unveilance, a cybersecurity firm based in Philadelphia. A self-described white hat, Hijazi used his knowledge and abilities to take down black hats, or hackers whose only interest was mayhem and money. But now, it seemed like the black hats had him. He'd received a message that was simply his email login password, followed by the words, "Let's talk." On Hijazi's screen was an IRC chat he was having with members of LulzSec, an elite group of hackers who'd splintered off from the larger group, Anonymous. They had hacked into Unveilance's server, pillaging thousands of extremely sensitive documents and emails. Now, they were threatening to release all of it on the web throughout torrent sites and hacker forums. Hijazi considered his response before finally typing,
"So, did we wrong you in some way? Let's get to the point."
He waited what felt like an eternity for a response. Finally, a new message from Lulz.
"If you wronged us, all of your affiliates would be crushed. Don't worry, you're in the good books. The point is a very crude word. Extortion."
Wait, what? Hijazi was confused. Is this just about money? While LulzSec was relatively unheard of at this point, its members had been part of the anonymous subgroup Internet Feds, responsible for the H.B. Gary hack as well as the live hack of the Westboro Baptist Church, and some of the key players in Operation Tunisia. Earlier that same month, LulzSec had carried out one of its larger hacks against InfraGuard, an Atlanta-based security company that was partnered with the FBI. In addition to stealing from InfraGuard, LulzSec also defaced the website.
"Let it flow, you stupid FBI battleships."
One of the companies that InfraGuard contracted was Hijazi's Unveilance. Adding insult to injury, LulzSec had gotten into Unveilance because Hijazi used the same password across both companies. Not only was this against FBI security protocol, for the head of a cybersecurity company, it was incredibly embarrassing. Now, Hijazi would have to decide whether he would play ball with LulzSec or risk exposing them to whatever government information they managed to steal in the breach. Karim looked from his computer screen at the black and white framed photos he'd taken of his wife, Brandy. They'd only been married a month. Unveilance wasn't that much older. His life was just getting started. And yet, LulzSec was threatening to blow it all apart with the click of a mouse. He didn't agree with Anonymous's methods, but he'd come to see them as kind of cyber-avenging angels, finding people and companies they deemed corrupt or evil and pawning them online.
"I thought at minimum there'd be some relief system, and there didn't seem to be anything behind it."
LulzSec was a different animal entirely. Amoral, ruthless, cocky, and very skilled. But who were they? And what were they all capable of? On this episode, government overthrows, dueling hackers, and FBI double agents. I'm Keith Korneluk, and you're listening to a bonus episode of Modem Mischief. You're listening to Modem Mischief. In this series, we explore the darkest reaches of the internet. We'll take you into the minds of the world's most notorious hackers and the lives affected by them. We'll also show you places you won't find on Google and what goes on down there. This is the story of Hector Monsegur and LulzSec. Hector Xavier Monsegur had lived in the same apartment in the Jacob Riis housing projects in the Lower East Side of New York his whole life. It was there, with his first computer, a Sony Vaio, that he downloaded the Hacker's Manifesto by the Mentor, and those words that initially inspired him.
"We exist without skin color, without nationality, without religious bias, and you call us criminals. You build atomic bombs, you wage wars, you murder, you cheat, and you lie to us, and you try to make us believe it's for our own good. yet we're the criminals?
When his father got busted for drugs, he was raised by his grandmother. Of course, she was no saintly grandmother. The family business was drug running, and the apartment they lived in was a stash house. Family members would come and go depending on convictions. Hector, a shy, awkward boy, would retreat into computers. Hector taught himself the open-source operating system Linux and was exposed to the world and anti-authoritarian beliefs of hacking.
I'm in New York City, Lower East Side in the 80s to early mid-90s. I dealt with a lot of racism from cops, not from people.
In 1999, the Marine Corps conducted a botched test bombing on the island of Vieques, accidentally killing a Puerto Rican man. Protests had erupted in both Puerto Rico and New York. The event would galvanize Monsegur politically. Adopting the online moniker Sabu, Hector took to the web, hacking into sites and leaving digital graffiti.
"Hello, I am Sabu. No one special for now," he wrote on the site. "The USA has treated Puerto Rico and its citizens like shit. All I want is the respect that I deserve. Or should I take it by force?"
The real world was harsh and oppressive for Hector. Despite being a promising student, he gets expelled following an altercation with a security guard who questions why he has a screwdriver. "I'm a geek that fixes the computer system." "Hey, don't give me attitude, boy." "I'm not giving you attitude. I am a student, and I work on the school's non-functioning computers." Online, Sabu was finding more success. He was quickly gaining a reputation as a leader, able to pull together hackers from all walks of life for a common purpose. In May of 2002, the 18-year-old launched a private club for programmers.
"I'm calling out all the New York Python hackers out here to come integrate their knowledge into one big mass of hairy information."
The club was part of a larger project, PureElite.org, an online hangout for fellow misfits and hackers looking to form connections. Hector described Pure Elite as, "my child, my birth, my manifestation." This is where he made one of his closest friends, Swedish-born Michelle Blomgren, and even starts a relationship with a girl from Oklahoma, despite probably never actually meeting her. Offline, Hector tried to take steps to escape. In his words,
"ghetto mentality with everyone talking shit and angry at society," he told Blomgren.
He successfully got into IT training programs for gifted youths. He even landed jobs at OpenPlans.org, an organization aimed at improving public transportation, but was fired after only a few months. In 2004, he thought he caught a break when his friend Blomgren launched a security firm called Tiger Team and brought his friend on as a member. But the company never actually got off the ground, and Hector was back on unemployment, working sporadically. In 2009, Hector's aunt, who gave him his first computer, was busted for heroin dealing, and her 2 7-year-old daughters came to live with Hector and Grandma Irma in the cramped 2-bedroom apartment. Grandma? Grandma! On July 6, 2010, Hector's grandmother died from complications due to diabetes. She raised him since he was a baby. Now, Hector was not just alone. He was the head of a household, and he needed money. Hacking as a political act went out. Sabu's sole drive was now income.
"I only hack for profit now. Gotta make that money," he wrote online.
He was on a crime spree, stealing credit card numbers, hacking into corporation servers, anything he could get his hands on.
"Yo, Poppy,"
he would message his friends on Facebook.
"I just got corporate account that had at least $400K in it."
Stealing a former employer's credit card, he hacked into an auto parts store and sent himself 4 engines worth over $3,000. He was living a double life. During the daytime, he was a concerned guardian, looking after his 2 cousins like they were his own daughters. He even referred to himself online as a proud parent. But when he got online, he became Sabu, confident, cunning, and cocky.
"You clearly don't know anything about me. How about you ask who Sabu is first before you talk shit, before you get owned into next year?"
Sabu had heard about this new group, Anonymous, that had grown out of 4chan. At first, he didn't think much of them. They seemed like immature pranksters just goofing off online. He'd grown out of that period in his life and was more focused on survival. But then he got wind of Anonymous's next planned attack, a DDoS against the financial institutions PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard. Following Chelsea Manning's arrest for leaking documents to WikiLeaks, donations started rolling in via PayPal. Due to political pressure, PayPal, Visa, and MasterCards barred sending any money to WikiLeaks. The obvious injustice reawakened Montsegur's old rebel spirit, and he was happy to join in the fight. On December 8, 2010, MasterCard and Visa both went offline. While PayPal was slowed down, the following day they agreed to release the funds to the WikiLeaks donation account. In January of 2011, the citizens of Tunisia were in revolt. The government was phishing their Facebooks and other logins, essentially to spy on them. As Tunisian activist Aziz Ameme put it,
"Here, we don't really have the internet. We have a national intranet."
Anonymous members took note, writing a script to bypass the government's internet spying. They sent this digital care package to a member of Anonymous in Tunisia named Yaz, who tested the script and distributed it to his fellow citizens. When Zebu got wind of a dictatorship suppressing its citizens' free speech, he sprang into action, taking advantage of Tunisia's antiquated servers and bringing down the government's internet completely for 5 hours. When it was back up, Zebu had hacked President Ben Ali's official site, scrawling his own digital graffiti. "Payback is a bitch, isn't it?" Signed, Operation Payback. On January 14, 2011, after nearly a month of protests, Tunisian President Ben Ali resigned from his position before fleeing to Saudi Arabia. The Tunisian revolt, part of the larger Arab Spring movement, had fought the oppressive government and won. Finally, Zebu had found a group that could make good on the hacker's manifesto. Anonymous was the real deal. There were three people in the chat room, called from the Internet Feds IRC. They were Zebu, Topiary, and one female, Kayla. A fourth joined, T-Flow. He was the one that brought them all together. Quiet and stoic, T-Flow hung back in the chat, allowing personalities to come out. Zebu was assertive and loquacious, yet deadly serious about what they were there for. A clear leader. He would call everyone my brother, and made them feel like they were part of the family. Topiary was cocky, witty, and creative. He achieved a sort of celebrity after live hacking the Westboro Baptist Church website while speaking with a Westboro member, Shirley Phelps Roper, on the David Pakman radio podcast. While not the strongest hacker, Anonymous had tapped in to write the official statement following Operation Payback. Then there was Kayla, which she claimed was her real name. A 16-year-old hacker who was so paranoid that she would boot up from a tiny micro SD card which she could swallow if she felt the heat around the corner. Kayla was playful and friendly, but also whip smart and deadly with a SQL attack. T-Flow was all business. He was the one that wrote the Grease Monkey script for Operation Tunisia. He was impressed with Cebu's takedown of the government internet, so he invited him to join these individuals, called from the best cast of Anonymous characters to do a job, Aaron Barr and H.B. Gary. Barr had made big claims about knowing who the leaders of Anonymous were and using that to gain traction for his company, H.B. Gary. Since Anonymous didn't have any leaders, they knew Barr was lying. He had to go down. Using a SQL attack, the group was able to get into H.B. Gary's server. Zebu used his hacker connections to problem-solve Barr's encrypted password, allowing them to access pretty much all of his data from emails to World of Warcraft.
"We have everything from his social security number to his career in the military to his clearances,"
Zebu bragged,
"to how many shits he takes in a day."
On Super Bowl 2011, the hackers performed an all-out attack on Barr, leaking all of his emails and taking over the H.B. Gary's website and posting a message from Anonymous written by Topiary.
"This domain has been seized by Anonymous under Section 14 of the Rules of the Internet. Greetings, H.B. Gary. Your recent claims of infiltrating Anonymous amuse us. And so do your attempts at using Anonymous as a means to garner press attention for yourself. How's this for attention? You've tried to bite at the Anonymous hand, and now the Anonymous hand is bitch-slapping you in the face."
You can hear more about Anonymous, Barr, and the attack of H.B. Gary on episode 28 of Modem Mischief. Ultimately, the embarrassment led to Barr's resignation. It was a complete coup for the group of Anonymous hackers. Not just for the hell of it, but to actually see the real-world fallout felt great. They were a winning team, each one contributing a different skill and superpower to the operation. Cebu was quick to capitalize on this. He proposed starting a small team that could carry out large-scale hacks against corrupt corporations, governments, and individuals, stealing information and releasing it to the public like they did with H.B. Gary. They all agreed they should not be constrained by Anonymous's broad principles of 1. Choosing targets because they were oppressors of free expression, and 2. Not attacking the media. The naming of the group fell to Tiflo and Topiary. Despite Cebu's commitment to serious action, the two realized the humor of the project. They were no longer tied in the somber importance of Anonymous. What they were embarking on was much more fun. It's gotta have lulls, Topiary insisted. Lulls leaks, suggested Tiflo. Lulls cannon. Yeah, that's a mouthful. We're going after their firewalls, their security. Topiary quickly checked Twitter. Lulzsec was free. He created and posted the group's introduction on Pastebin.
Hello, good day, and how are you? Splendid, we're Lulzsec, a small team of lulzy individuals who feel the drabness of the cyber community is a burden on what matters. Fun!
Kayla had a scanning script that allowed her to scour the web for vulnerabilities in large corporations. One of her first hits was Fox, specifically the singing competition show The X Factor. On May 7, 2011, Topiary sent out his first tweet under the Lulzsec handle.
We're releasing the X Factor contestants database publicly tonight. Stay tuned. Wink, wink, double wink.
With that, Topiary sent out a link to a torrent file containing the database. And then, silence. Barely any attention. Lulzsec had dropped their first big hack and met with crickets. Anonymous insiders started following Lulzsec Twitter, but it didn't attract much attention anywhere else. The other members weren't too worried considering the other projects they had lined up. They'd already attacked InfraGuard and, by extension, Unveilance, but keeping that secret to accumulate as much data as they could, even listening to FBI conference calls. In mid-May, Cebu watched an episode of PBS's Frontline about Chelsea Manning and WikiLeaks. It enraged him the way they presented Manning and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in a dark light. Cebu proposed hacking PBS. The Lulzsec team was in. Kayla quickly found a breach in the PBS server, and Cebu and the others went out ransacking information. Most notable was the fake story Topiary published on the PBS homepage.
Tupac found alive in New Zealand.
They also had passwords of nearly every PBS journalist and logins for all the affiliate stations. The article soon went viral on Facebook and Twitter, while PBS scrambled to take it down. The stories of the hack were picked up by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Of all the interview requests, Lulzsec only granted one to Forbes, wherein Topiary said,
"While our main goal is to spread entertainment, we do greatly wish that Bradley Manning hears about this and at least smiles."
The next day, the story was in every major news publication. Donations were flooding in through the Lulzsec Bitcoin account. Topiary was gaining Twitter followers by the thousands. From a single stunt, Lulzsec seemed less like a hacking collective and more like rock stars. But already, they were making enemies. Following the PBS hack, Lulzsec was on a roll. As a follow-up, they dropped the InfraGuard data along with Unveilance. That first scene, with Kareem Hijazi trying to deal with Lulzsec extorting him, that was his side of the story. That the hackers had contacted him and tried to blackmail him, or else they would release documents they'd obtained during the hack. According to Lulzsec, once Kareem found out he'd been hacked, he initiated a conversation. The Lulzsec members joined him on a private IRC.
You hacked my company. What about the others? If the price is right, who do you have in mind?
Kayla would later say they were just stringing him along and ultimately released the data anyway.
If he wanted money, we could have taken it in a much quieter way, just hack into some banks.
Hijazi went on the defense, issuing his own statement about how Lulzsec tried to extort him, but he stood firm, refusing to negotiate with the cyber terrorists. One of the reasons Cebu and Kayla had targeted InfraGuard was that it was being a contractor for the FBI. The ACLU described the company as turning private sector corporations into surrogate eyes and ears for the FBI. The irony of this being that Lulzsec was actually able to hack into InfraGuard's conference calls with the FBI as they discuss Lulzsec. And it's all available for you to listen to on YouTube. NATO and the Pentagon had recently stated that hacking could be construed as an act of war. In a statement to Pastebin, Lulzsec explained their motive behind the hack.
It has come to our unfortunate attention that NATO and our good friend Barack Osama Lama 24th Century Obama have recently upped the stakes with regard to hacking. They now treat hacking as an act of war. So we just hacked the FBI-affiliated website, InfraGuard, specifically the Atlanta chapter, and leaked its user base. We also took complete control over the site and defaced it.
This was another big win for Lulzsec and garnered more media attention. It was also directly in line with Cebu's philosophy about hacking for a political purpose. They were calling out the hypocrisy and corruption, as well as the pathetic nature of these institutions' cybersecurity. With Lulzsec's reputation growing, Cebu decided it was time to bring in reinforcements. The core six members of Cebu, T-Flow, Kayla, Topiary, Pawn Sauce, and UV Unit would remain, but Cebu invited on some of his old hacking friends from the late 90s underground scene. Cebu named this subgroup Pure Elite after his old hacking club from the 90s. Topiary was a little uneasy about expanding Lulzsec, fearing the bigger it got, the more chance for spies and traitors. But Cebu calmed his fears, saying these were the only hackers he trusted 100%. No one is trustable outside our crew. Remember that. In private, Cebu confided in Topiary that he hoped this expanded group might lead to another anti-security movement like the one in the early 2000s that captured so many headlines. Lulzsec was racking up more wins. In June, they managed to hack Sony with a simple SQL attack, capturing and releasing thousands of users' information. They hacked the U.S. Senate and even pulled off a DDoS attack against the CIA's official website. But Topiary was right to be nervous. With such a high profile and the fact that Lulzsec was releasing usernames and data from whatever site they hacked, they were making enemies. Their cockiness and bravado didn't help. One of Lulzsec's major adversaries was the ex-military, pro-government hacker known as Joker. Joker had made an online career of going after Anonymous and WikiLeaks. Joker and Lulzsec would sling insults at each other across Twitter and IRC and occasionally attack one another with DDoSes. Joker vowed he'd be the one to unmask the members of this elite hacker group. The other members agreed with Topiary that things were spinning out of control. There were too many people hanging around the chats. UV Unit had already left the Core 6, sensing danger. Plus, after the InfraGuard hack, they knew the feds were hot on their tail. On June 25, 2011, Lulzsec announced their final data dump from an AT&T hack and hung up its spurs, putting an end to an unprecedented 50 days of epic hacking. But by then, it was too late. Little did the Lulzsec members know that the FBI had already turned their incorruptible leader Cebu into one of their informants. Looking back, the members of Lulzsec did remember that on June 7, 2011, in the midst of Lulzsec's peak of hacking infamy, their leader Cebu suddenly disappeared for 2 days. 2 days later, he returned. The Core 6 asked where he went. He shrugged them off, saying that he had to take care of some real-life stuff. It was back to business, but he was never quite the same. As Topiary recalls,
"Asking us to assert certain things that we all allegedly knew to be true, and then making us say them again and again for very little reason."
The reason was that Cebu had been visited by the FBI, which you can hear more about in our Anonymous episode. Not wanting to lose custody of his two cousins, which he considered his daughters, Cebu took the deal and continued hacking for Lulzsec, only now with the FBI tracking every move. Hector took to his new role just as fervently as he did to his role as a political hacker. Once, when he was stopped by an NYPD officer, Cebu told him, "Relax, I'm a federal agent." He would later be charged with impersonating a federal agent. Despite this, he was a model informant, claimed his FBI handler.
"Staying up sometimes all night, helping the government build cases."
Even after Lulzsec split up, Monsegur continued to inspire hackers to go out and commit crimes, then report them. Hackers would pass on cyber vulnerabilities, which he would pass on to the FBI to patch up. On March 6, 2012, authorities made their move. They arrested Topiary, who was revealed to be an 18-year-old Jake Davies from the Sheffield Islands. He and his computer were seized and flown to London for processing. He was sentenced to 24 months and ended up serving 38 days due to time served. He now works as a security researcher, finding bugs for corporations. T-Flow, or 16-year-old Mustafa Al-Bassam, was arrested and sentenced to 20 months suspended sentence and a 2-year ban from the internet. He went on to found, you guessed it, a blockchain company. PawnSauce was arrested as Darren Martin, a 19-year-old biopharmaceutical chemistry student at a university in the small city of Galway, Ireland, and received a 9-month suspended sentence. Perhaps the biggest upset was the arrest of Kayla as Ryan Aykroyd, a London-based programmer and a veteran of the Iraq War. Many of Kayla's fellow hackers admitted to having a crush on her. Aykroyd served a 30-month sentence. The last of the LulzSec Core 6, AV Unit, he remains at large. In a Reddit AMA, someone claiming to be AV Unit said this of LulzSec: the longer I was with them, they began to get lazy in terms of hiding their identity. Once I realized that, I realized the ship was sinking. Hector Monsegur, the pure warrior once known as Cebu, has turned into a white hat. He now works as a cybersecurity consultant with his former FBI handler, Chris Tarbell. Online, he's reviled by his former hacker community as a Benedict Arnold. LulzSec burned bright, but very brief, their reign of terror lasting only 50 days. Whether they were a malicious gang or hackers looking to point out crucial flaws in the world of cybersecurity is up for you to decide. I'm Keith Korneluk, and you're listening to a bonus episode of Modem Mischief. Thanks for listening to Modem Mischief. This show is an independent production and is wholly supported by you, our listeners. And if you're hearing this show, that means that you support us on Patreon or Apple Podcasts, and we're grateful as all hell for you. Modem Mischief is brought to you by Mad Dragon Productions and is created, produced, and hosted by me, Keith Korneluk. This episode is written and researched by Ed Lear. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Greg Bernhard. The theme song You Are Digital is composed by Computer Bandit. And don't forget to follow us on social media at Modem Mischief. And thanks for listening.